Welcome, listeners, to time for an awakening on Black Talk Radio Network, new media for the new millennia. This is a history and current events program from a cultural perspective. We find this program necessary because Hosea 4:6 states, "My people are destroyed for the lack of knowledge." But we as a people can turn this around. Proverbs 4:7 states, "Wisdom is the principal thing. Therefore, get wisdom. And with all that getting, get an understanding." Again, welcome to the program this evening with your hosts, Brother Elliot and Brother Richard. The number to reach us to join the conversation this evening is 215-490-9832. That's 215-490-9832. We're streaming live at several locations. You can go to timeforanawakening.com, which is the homepage, and listen to the live stream from that location. You can go to www.blacktalkradionetwork.com. Again, that's www.blacktalkradionetwork.com/timeforanawakening and hear the live stream there also. You can go to ourradionetwork.com. Again, that's ourradionetwork.com/timeforanawakening, which is in the Black Belt, and listen to the live stream at that location. Or you can download TuneIn to any of your handheld devices. TuneIn is a free app. And in that TuneIn search engine, just type in Time for an Awakening. There you'll see the icon, and you can stream the program live, even into your car if you have the Bluetooth capabilities or an auxiliary connection. Again, it's Time for an Awakening radio program with the live stream on the TuneIn app. Drop us an email at timeforanawakening@gmail.com. Again, it's timeforanawakening@gmail.com. Time for Awakening also has a fan page on Facebook. In that Facebook search engine, you can type in Time for an Awakening radio program. There you always see interesting content being posted daily. And do me a favor, before you leave that page, hit that like button. That's Time for an Awakening radio program with the fan page on Facebook and Time for an Awakening media. The homepage is there. Should be one of your favorites, but if not, do me a favor, put that in your address bar and make it one. Plenty of new content being posted all the time. Podcasts of the new programs on Time for an Awakening, where you can download, listen at later times, or even share with your friends. So again, make that one of your favorites. Put that in the address bar. That's timeforanawakening.com. Timeforanawakening.com will take you straight to Time for an Awakening Media. Tonight, we have a guest joining us, activist and educator Akil Parker will be with us. Pan-Africanism will be part of the conversation this evening, and we'll be right back to get things started after a brief word from our sponsors.
Mr. Moderator, our distinguished guests, brothers and sisters, our friends and our enemies. Everybody is here.
You are listening to Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasts or live programming, hit them up at timeforanawakening.com.
All Insurance Incorporated, an African-American owned and operated insurance agency in business for over 20 years, located at 231 Southeastern Road in Glenside, PA, with other offices in Germantown and West Philadelphia. Call now for commercial insurance quotes, homeowners insurance quotes, automobile insurance quotes, notary and tax services, representing over 15 major A-rated insurance companies, offering a discount on all notary services when you call in for a free quote. Call this number, 215-885-2444. That number is 215-885-2444. 215-885-2444. All Insurance Incorporated.
Before you your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley. Dooley Brothers, specializing in shingle, rubber roofs, gutters, downspouts, and vinyl sidings. Call for your free estimate today. 215-224-3882. That's 215-224-3882. Dooley Brothers Roofing, the roofing experts you can trust. That number again, 215-224-3882. 215-224-3882. Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley.
RG Electrical Inspections provides electrical inspections for realtors, licensed electricians, and homeowners. Licensed and insured underwriter, serving Philadelphia and surrounding area. Call today, 484-268-9837.
Overworked? Suffering with an underperforming company, headache customer, staff, or vendors? Or are you a startup who wants to get it right the first time and avoid the costly mistakes? We turned a $24,000 a year odd job handyman service into a seven-figure high-end custom home builder and commercial contractor licensed and operating in three states. This is just one transformation created for entrepreneurs like you in various industries around the country. Not what you're used to from accounting and business consulting? Well, welcome to New Business Solutions. If you're ready to go beyond advising, coaching, and training and get implemented results, call 301-244-9072. Let New Business Solutions apply the best comprehensive administrative, accounting, operations, human resources, management, sales, and marketing to help you actualize your vision for yourself and your company. From anywhere nationally, call 301-244-9072. Spelled new as in numerous on your device right now. Book your free consultation at newbusinesssolutions.com.
History is a clock that people use to tell their political and cultural time of day. It is also a compass that people use to find themselves on the map of human geography. History tells of people where they have been and what they have been, where they are and what they are. Most important, history tells a people where they still must go, what they still must be. The relationship of history to the people is the same as the relationship of a mother to her child.
From antiquity to the present, our people need to develop a new paradigm. It's time for an awakening with your host, Brother Elliot. Sundays, 7 p.m., Fridays at 8 p.m. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit us up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
Welcome back to Time for an Awakening. And before we get started with our program this evening, I want to welcome in my co-host, Philadelphia activist and tour guide at the African American Museum. Here in Philadelphia, Brother Richard is with us. Brother Richard.
Yes, sir, Brother Elliot.
How are you, sir?
I'm doing fine. The day has been like a slow day, but I'm kind of excited now that we're going to engage in this conversation, or really maybe thinking through some things with Brother Akil around education, nationalism, Pan-Africanism, and the questions of... not where do we go from here as far as public or independent educational institutions.
It should be an interesting dialogue with our guest, Brother Akil Parker. Brother Richard, you said that you ran into Brother Akil at the Freedom and Reconstruction League presentation he was doing in reference to David Walker.
Yes, definitely. And he did it, and I have to be fair, one who's been looking at David Walker for some years, Brother Akil kind of really energized me, because I think every year, I've said this before, every year I try to read the appeal. And I would say in the last 2 years, I might have been slipping. So when I seen Brother Parker was developing that, and Mariah Stewart,
mm-hmm.
because no one really... really picked up on that. She really picked up on what he was doing as a woman of that period. But she also, one of the speeches that I really liked when I read it from her, really got down on Black men at the time in relationship to what we always talk about, taking our manhood back. That's the way I would conceptualize, summarize her presentation of the time. So I was really glad that Brother Akil O'Connor really went to develop that and showed what David Walker and Sister Mariah was actually developing in the 19th century, that we should be taking lessons and maybe echoing in the 21st century.
Well, listen, it's going to be interesting dialogue for us and for the listening audience. Before we get started and bring Brother Akil on, I want to play a clip that will kind of set things up. It's from Message to the Grassroots, Brother Malcolm in 1963. Let me cue this up, and then we'll bring on Brother Akil.
We all agree tonight, all of the speakers have agreed, that America has a very serious problem. Not only does America have a very serious problem, but our people have a very serious problem. America's problem is us. We're her problem. The only reason she has a problem is she doesn't want us here. And every time you look at yourself, be you black, brown, red, or yellow, a so-called Negro, you represent a person who poses such a serious problem for America because you're not wanted. Once you face this as a fact, then you can start plotting a course that will make you appear intelligent instead of unintelligent. What you and I need to do is learn to forget our differences. When we come together, we don't come together as Baptists or Methodists. You don't catch hell because you're a Baptist, and you don't catch hell because you're a Methodist. You don't catch hell because you're a Methodist or a Baptist. You don't catch hell because you're a Democrat or a Republican. You don't catch hell because you're a Mason or an Elk. And you sure don't catch hell because you're an American, because if you was an American, you wouldn't catch no hell. You catch hell because you're a black man. You catch hell, all of us catch hell for the same reason.
We want to welcome into the program activist and educator, Brother Akil Parker. Brother Akil, are you there?
I am. Peace, brothers.
How are you, sir?
How you doing now?
I'm doing well. I came down with a slight cold, but I'm still good. I'm still ready to work.
Brother Akil, you know, I played that clip to kind of set up the conversation this evening. From one of my heroes. I've read the appeal on two occasions. I loaned out my book a couple of years ago. And that's a problem that I have. Sometimes I loan out some of my books. I've loaned out the appeal and never got it back. But it's a couple of things that strikes me in that book. And I want you to kind of set up the conversation of the appeal with the critical discussion that should be, that we should have had when Malcolm raised this issue of 40 or 50 years ago. David Walker put it in writing in the early 1800s, when he made the appeal to colored citizens. Marcus Garvey kind of put it into action in the early 20th century. The discussion of what the polemic that our people find themselves in and what we must do about it. You see a lot of our people now, they're putting all their eggs in a Democratic Party basket, so to speak. Everything is politics, and that's going to alleviate this problem for our people. But talk about it from the perspective of David Walker, the message that he was trying to get through, and then we're going to bring it up to the present, because you're an educator in the Philadelphia public school system, and you can talk about it in relation to our students that's in these classrooms now. But talk about it from David Walker's perspective in brief, which you picked up that he was trying to get our people to understand then.
So the 19th century, David Walker, in his appeal, is trying to get our people to understand that, for one thing, none of us are free, so to speak, even if you weren't on a plantation, we all are linked, by our treatment as people of African descent in this society. even if you were like I said, like on a not on a plantation, then, you know, you still so there's a reason and there's a necessity for you to try to do the work necessary to try to help, you know, our sisters and brothers that, you know, were on those plantations, you know, to get off and to overthrow this system of chattel slavery. I think that's his general message in the appeal, and really a call to arms, or a call to rebellion, to overthrow the slavery system, which still persists today, but it just has changed form. It was never really truly abolished. That's work that still needs to be done. You know, that we still have to do today in 2018, try to abolish this slavery system, even if it's not a chattel slavery system. It's still a slavery system where we're not able to realize our full humanity.
Well, you know, that system of white supremacy that David Walker basically talked about, and he didn't term it that, but that's what it is. And you're right.
Right.
It's still here. And the education system that we send our children to basically sets us up to become the same type of individuals in this modern form of system that our ancestors were in that time. The only thing that we're not in physical chains, but to be used by this system is still present in the education system that we face now. But talk about it from the perspective of the critical discussion that we need to have in before we get to the places of education. We need to have, because Malcolm talked about the barriers that stop us, and he started talking about religion. I think that's one of the frontline places that education must start, is in spaces that we tend to control. And even now, we still tend to control, to a certain extent, the places where we worship. Even though a lot of times education is not going on there, it's more of spirituality, what they can term spirituality, or reading the Bible, or reading the Quran, things of that nature. But it's no culturally based education that's going on there to help free our children, or at least arm our children to the things we're going to need to move our people forward. Talk about it from your perspective of being in the classrooms, seeing what our children need, and trying to make these things real to our children so they can understand what they're up against.
Well, I noticed, like, on the before the show began, there was an excerpt from a Dr. Clark,
yes,
speak, and one of the things that I always remember from Dr. Clark, adamant about when he discussed education, was that our children need to be educated to become responsible handlers of power, and that ties into people like, you know, more contemporary people, also like Kwame Ture, speaking about Black Power, and you know, how he said, you know, racism is really more of an issue of power. You know, like, you know, if a white man wants to lynch me, that's, you know, his problem. But if a white man has the power to lynch me, then that's my problem. That's something I got to worry about. So the education, if it's going to be meaningful for us, to develop our youth from the beginning to be responsible handlers of power, and also to, if we get into like Amos Wilson, him talking about us needing to use education to solve our problems, use intelligence to solve our problems. But what ends up happening is, and this kind of goes into those two essays that I sent to you, especially the one on so-called good schools. We get, you know, we're schooled and trained to solve the problems of other people, other groups of people. And then that becomes the goal to solve the problems of other people, and it's supposed to be acceptable as long as we can make a comfortable salary doing it. But, you know, as a collective and as a group, entity, we never have power. We never have the, we're always at the mercy of other people, you know, and whether they'll allow us to exist in a certain way. We don't have group power, and education should really, ideally, should serve to do that. And, like, you know, other groups understand this, and many of us understand it, but we haven't achieved the power to be able to enforce that. The force that will be able to, in large numbers, be able to train our children and educate our children to be responsible handlers of power for our community. And so we can actually have a community, because some would argue that there is no black community, that there's a bunch of neighborhood people that happen to be black just living there. Some would make that argument, make a convincing argument, that when you think about what a community means, what it means to have, again, speaking of black nationalism, what it means to have political control of your community, economic control of your community, control of the social institutions. And, you know, Malcolm X speaks about this in The Ballad or the Bullet in 1964, also, like what that should look like.
Brother Parker, one more question, and I'm going to pass it over to Brother Richard. The quote-unquote term good schools, because I knew that you had mentioned this a couple of times in your writings, because of our people seem to be fixated, some of our people, to sending their children to good schools. The system of white supremacy uses the quote-unquote good schools to nurture their young to further the system of white supremacy. That's obvious because we've been here 400 years, and there's been countless generations of new white children that have come along. And the system hasn't changed. It has morphed. It hasn't changed its overall edict or premise. So if that's the case, then what are these good schools training our children to do?
The goal of the good school, and this is not to say that every individual will suffer that fate, because they may have some type of cultural grounding.
Okay. Go ahead.
From their parents.
Go ahead.
From their household. Which kind of like vaccinates them or anesthetizes them to protect them from that, but it's meant to train them to be assimilationist.
Okay.
Basically, the goal is for them, and I speak as a person that went to so called good schools in Baltimore, Maryland, and I was being trained to be an assimilationist Negro, and in retrospect, I look back at a lot of my thinking and a lot of the worldview that I possessed as a result of having been socialized by that school system, and a lot of my peers as well, because, you know, we were never thinking about taking control of our communities. That wasn't even a thought. We were thinking about, well, we go to the so-called good schools, so therefore we'll go to to colleges, and then we'll get degrees, and then we'll go make money working for the white man. And that really becomes the goal. But then I think what we have to do as a community, and even if not as a community, there's some of us, you know, that are concerned about our well-being as a group, have to think more critically about the definition of a good school. Like, what does that really look like? Does it just mean that, you know, we're going to have some uncomfortable conversations, and we're going to have to challenge a lot of our preconceived notions. And, you know, and we have to kind of question and push back on some of the pride that's been instilled in us, because we're alumni of these institutions. When we look at, you know, how being a member, being enrolled in those institutions, how that really was a tool and a form of, like, weaponry used against us, really just to keep us from developing our own independent institutions where we could become responsible handlers of power. It's like a lot of these so-called good schools. I don't know if there's any, like, you know, they're maybe 100 years old, over 100 years old. And once upon a time, we weren't even allowed to go there. But then, you know, because, like, H. Rap Brown talks about 1968, the Free Huey Rally, he talked about how a lot of our people, we confuse progress with concessions. So the white power structure will make concessions, maintain their power over us. But we look at that as a lot of times as a game, but a lot of us were able to go to these so-called good schools, just so that we wouldn't develop our own good schools that would really nurture us and really help us to develop our communities in certain ways. So it's really, like I said, it's a chess move. And, you know, we get finessed. We don't even realize it.
Well, let me...
but at some point, we're going to have to recognize when we get finessed, and we got to stop getting finessed.
Let me say this, and Richard, I'm gonna pass it to you.
No, go ahead.
Because it's something that Brother Keel mentioned, said, because we had this conversation Friday when one of our callers from New York mentioned about the Negro peens. That's the term
right.
we use.
You
mentioned that what helped you, because the so-called good schools is designed to teach young white children how to further cement or further push the system of white supremacy, to be gatekeepers for white supremacy. But it teaches black children to become assimilationists. But you
right.
said,
well, I think it also teaches the black children to be gatekeepers for white supremacy, but to serve as a black face of white power.
Okay. But you said
– like with the neo-colonialism that, you know, Malcolm X talks about, I think the last message the week before he's assassinated, he says, all goodbyes don't mean I'm gone. And, you know, he says, you know, in the continent of Africa with a lot of the independence movements, the European nations, what they do is they say, okay, well, we'll allow you. And think about that. You know, they allow them to be sovereign nations, but they were never really supposed to be sovereign. But they're going to still control the economics of the nation. They're still going to control the resources within those nations. But they're going to be back in France, back in Great Britain, back in Denmark, back in Germany, back in Portugal, back in Italy or wherever. But you're going to have black prime ministers. You're going to have continental African prime ministers and presidents. And colonial governors, so that's part of the neo-colonialism, and a lot of us get caught up in the whole thing. We don't understand that all your skin folk ain't your kinfolk. We would like for them to be, but you know, oftentimes you know they're not. So you know, we really have to be critical of, like, you know, what is the political orientation of these people. Like, and are they race for, like you mentioned Marcus Garvey, are they race first, or are they trying to fulfill some type of goals that they have? You know, are they just, you know, trying to take advantage of are they being out just opportunistic?
So school feeds
the neo-colonialism.
But you mentioned that the thing that helped anesthetize you against that was the cultural background given to you by your parents.
Right. So I was fortunate. My mother, my father was a teacher, was a history teacher. And at the same time, my mother, she, you know, I was born in New York, and my mother went to Hunter College. My mother took coursework with John Henry Clark and Marimba Ani. So in my household, I had, when I was from a very young age, I was given an awareness of these things. So even though as I grew older, I strayed away from that, you know, because I wanted to assimilate. I wanted to fit in. I wanted to be like everybody else. That those seeds had already been planted within my psyche and within my mindset. So get back to it. Because it had been planted. But a lot of us, so in a way, when I speak like I'm speaking right now, and when I, you know, post things that I post on social media, I also recognize that I speak from a space of privilege. But the hope is that a lot more of our, you know, our children will be able to have the privileges that I had, being tied into institutions that are meant to develop us culturally and have us be culturally grounded instead of having us strive to be American. Because I think that's another problem. Because when we really get into, again, with critical thinking, when we really get into what it means to be an American, being an American is anti-African. always has been. And this, that goes back to David Walker, because the things that he was writing about in the appeal and the slavery system itself is, you know, very American. You know, it's based upon the denial. America's grounding, and everything in America is grounded on denial of the humanity of African people. I mean, the denial of humanity of a lot of people, but mainly African people, and it always has been. So I think we have to be more honest about that. So despite the fact that there may be some black people that give the appearance of being able to live comfortably and have large sums of money in bank accounts and drive expensive cars and live in huge houses and have huge, like I said, huge bank accounts. Because it's not about the individual, it's about the collective.
Brother Richard.
You know, I wanted to once again give Brother Keeler's a kudos for, and I didn't know what he just said. So most of the things I've been seeing has been coming through social media. And I want to say he didn't know what he just said in relationship to his personal development. And I think that, you know, Elliot, that we, especially those who, I'm assuming, help me out on this, Brother Akil, would you be considered in that group called the millennials?
I've seen technical definitions for millennial, and I've seen some technical definitions. I was born in 1980. Mm-hmm. I've seen technical definitions that would place me within that group, but I think the connotation of what a millennial is, I don't feel that I fit into. Like, I have a younger sister that's 20. She just turned 26 years old. We kind of joke with her, mess with her. We say she's a millennial, but I'll be 38 next month. You know, so but again, like I said, like the technical definition of a millennial, I may fit within that.
And that's basically what I'm speaking to, because the point I wanted to make was the point of the distinction of being able to see someone within your age group having that cultural grounding. Those of us who come out who are considered the boomers, right? Who come out of a different, who may have been a part of, you know, your parents and whatever, being a part of that generation that got that understanding that was to pass that on. And what I appreciate about this discussion is the point that we always say, and Ella, you always bring, that there's young people out here. And, you know, you may see yourself as older, but there's young compared to others, you know, in the listening audience or whatever. There's young people that are out there that, I mean, there's who think that young people aren't really carrying that ideological, philosophical, organizational thrust. And it's good to hear, or even, and this goes to the question I'm going to ask based off of what you were saying, because you said, what are some of the, there will be some uncomfortable conversations. So my question is, as you see it from your vantage point of your generational vantage point, what do you see as some of the uncomfortable conversations that we have to have as it relates to the orientation of training and education and being in this here American system?
Well, just for one, like people that attended like good schools and so-called, I got to say so-called, I have to put that qualifier on it, the so-called good schools in whatever city you're in, whether it be Washington, D.C., whether it be Baltimore, Philadelphia, New York City, you know, L.A., wherever. Because, it, you know, you have to work hard for admission into those spaces, those educational spaces. And, you know, you have to really apply yourself and assert yourself academically and intellectually. Then, you know, for people that, you know, if we look at this in a political sense, you know, dealing with in terms of the collective, you know, what if we said, you know, it's kind of like when I taught at Central High School here in Philly 2 years ago. And, you know, one day I had the opportunity, I was having a conversation with some of my geometry students. And I told these, you know, these young sisters, I said, you know, cool that you go to this school, you go to Central, but you really go here. You should be thinking like this. You might want to think like this. You go here so that your children won't have to, you know? And I have a lot of friends that, you know, I went to a so-called good school in Baltimore, and, you know, their children now go to that same school. So I think that what we have to start thinking about, I mean, you know what, we can go there and get the technical training, develop ourselves academically. It's still not ideal. It's not an ideal situation. It may be sufficient. It may have some sufficiency. It's not an ideal situation, because we still have to worry about the white supremacy that's very innate in the curriculum, and just the idea that we have to go to their institutions. Like, those aren't our institutions. So we have to think about, like, you know, being able to saying no, kind of rejecting and pushing back on those institutions, and saying, okay, well, let's build our own institutions. Let's do some. Let's start thinking independently, like, you know, a good brother, Carl Tone Jones, with his documentary, The Independence Day Project. You know, he's talking about that in all areas of our existence. You know, independence, and just well, I realize that it's really just, I think primarily we have to develop an independent mindset, and then from doing that, then we'll develop the confidence that we can have our own institutions that are on par with or superior to the institutions controlled by the Europeans. I mean, we're the first human beings, and, you know, we developed a lot of the mathematical concepts and principles and scientific concepts and principles, and, you know, our intellectual history goes back very far, even before the existence of a European. So this idea that we have to be educated by them, and like Dr. Clark said, you know, they're latecomers to the party. Like, we were already here. When you think about it in that context, it seems kind of ridiculous that we would feel like we have to be, you know, go to those institutions. Now, here's the main problem. It's not going to be easy. It's going to be very. It's probably one of the most difficult things that we could ever do, because I think that, I don't want to say quiet is kept, but I think the reality is that, like, the educational space is probably it's the most important institution in any society, because it's, you know, where children are socialized. It's, you know, where you gain knowledge that you'll use to live, to exist as a human being, to procure food, clothing, and shelter. It's like this is where the battle is fought. You know, like Jacob Carruthers is discussing intellectual warfare. You know, intellectual warfare is taking place, like, inside these schools. And school is a common denominator. Like, everybody went to a school. You know, that's the thing that makes us, that gives us a commonality. Like, that we were schooled somewhere, somehow. But then the question is, like, what, how were we educated? Were we miseducated? Were we diseducated? Were we educated?
And you know, that's the thing I wanted to explore with, you know, us, you know, in the audience. And I hope that the audience also gets involved in it, because, say, for Philadelphia, and you raised a point earlier that it's about power and the question of whether we are a community or neighborhoods, as you characterize it. Now, I'm one who say that we have been trying to create communities at different historical points, but we're really a population who lives in a neighborhood. And that's the reason why there is this powerlessness there. But the point that I wanted to raise to kind of push, because I seen that you were running, you put your name in, Philadelphia went from a state-controlled elected school, state-controlled school board, state and city-controlled school board, to now the mayor wanted to have a local-controlled school board, and it was asking for people to be, that he would select to be part of that. And you put your name in that, right. In that process. And dealing with this question about power, how did that experience, what was that experience to you?
Well, it allowed me to speak on the inside, just to an extent why they probably would have never chose me anyway. you know, it's interesting. You know, I guess before I answer this question, I mean, you know, in terms of educational questions about power, more recently I've been thinking about Frank Rizzo. Mm-hmm. And the reason I've been thinking about Frank Rizzo was because I recently found out that one of the things that he intended to do and did do when he became mayor, when he went from being the police commissioner to the mayor, was one of the first things he said he was going to do was get rid of the superintendent at the time, which was Mark Shedd, I believe. I could be mistaken, but I think it was Mark Shedd. But just to show, so we understand Rizzo being the type of toxic, you know, individual that, you know, he was, and, you know, having the brothers in the Black Panther Party, like, you know, stripped down naked and, you know, having their, you know, being dehumanized, demoralized, and, you know, him just being that type of individual. But I think the even what's even deeper and it's even more impactful was his even understanding, like, okay, because what Mark Shedd was going to do was he was going to, and this comes like after the 67 student walkout, where, you know, Black students are demanding Black studies, more African-American teachers, more African-American administrators, and just meant different things, you know, to enhance the quality of their education. And they wanted more culturally responsive curriculum and pedagogy. They wanted all those things. And Mark Shedd at least claimed that he was going to do these things. What Rizzo says is, no, we can't allow that. We got to get rid of him. So just understanding that. So that also leads me to believe that, you know, more, I think, you know, I would like to do more research around that. But it also exposes how, you know, this is what a battle is really for in these classrooms. Because you're talking about socializing these children. Now, going forward, the School Reform Commission used to be a 5-member body. 3 people were appointed by the governor, and 2 people were appointed by the mayor. Now you have 9 people appointed by the mayor, but still not a democratically elected school board. Again, I think, you know, maybe it's another concession, like H. Rat Brown talked about, you know, another concession. So you still have, because what the mayor does is the mayor picks a group of 13 people, which is a nominating board or a nominating group. Out of those 13 people, they picked 27. They were supposed to pick 27 people. From those 27 people, the mayor and his staff are supposed to narrow down the list to 9 people. And they'll have 9 board members. Now, the 27 people that they chose, the mayor wasn't satisfied with. So he did have the option, and he exercised the option to have the 13-member board give him additional names. So the 13-member board, it's a lot of numbers, you know, I'm throwing around here, but the 13-member board gave him 18 more names from the original pool. So he had 45 people to choose from. And those 45 people, he then chose 9 people, 9 board members. You know, like I said, I threw my name, threw my hat in the ring to kind of see what would happen. And I could tell on the second interview I went on with the mayor's staff that, now, because I was very candid and very honest about, you know, what I was there for. And I can kind of foresee myself being the one person that might, you know, be arguing with these other 8 people that are trying to maintain status quo, you know, and of these other 8 people that are not really trying to help or enable Black children in this city to gain any type of power and be responsible handlers of power. But that's what I would have been there for, you know, if I'd have been in that position.
And, you know, the difference between that you made, as you gave the historical reference of the walkout in 68 and what Rizzo did in relationship to the concessions, the political force that Shedd was supposed to show. And the point I wanted to make is because those students, going to your personal experience, those students were organized specifically by other members in the community to do that walkout and to have those planks and platforms that was presented to the education board. It wasn't just students as in their own, coming out of their own sphere. So the community was organized in that sense. And I think that that was you know, what we, when we're talking about what you mentioned about earlier, about power and the distinction between being what I would say a population and what I, you know, compared to a community, is that the social organization out of the community motivated the students to utilize their position within the educational system to gain the political position that they had. Now, the ball may have been dropped by the time Rizzo came in, and a whole lot of other things were going on, but it does, that if we look at it historically, we can see with the point that you make as far as the power that's necessary for education, which goes to another question. Now, you know, Ellie, you can, you know, take it back to you, but in your paper, you raised this and it brought some questions to my mind. You said, many, and going to the same thing, many among us complain of the behavior of our youth in school. The operative word is our. If we take ownership of our children, the concern will naturally follow. What did you mean by that?
I'm trying to look for that line. That's in the no such thing as failing schools.
No such thing as failing schools. And I, so that's on the fourth page, as I got it, and further down.
Right, the fact that they're not our schools. Mm. You know, just like, I often think about this. Like we as blacks in America, we have an issue with pronouns in terms of how we use the English language. And again, Malcolm has a quote for that too. You know, when he's on the Battle of the Bullet, he's talking about, you know, I heard a Negro say, "Our astronauts." He said they won't even let him near the plane. How they are astronauts. So the schools are not ours at the current moment. They need to be ours. You know, but they're not ours. So whether we create independent schools that are ours or more of them, because there are some independent schools, not enough to service all of the children of African descent in the whole country. But we gain community control of the current schools. So something's got to give, and maybe it should be a two-prong approach. I think in Russell Rickford's work, We Are an African People, he documents the independent schools movement in the 1960s and 1970s, and, you know, a lot of their successes and a lot of their failures. And there was a two-prong approach. Like, some people were saying, okay, we need independent schools, so we're going to do this. So you have, like, John Churchville right here in North Philly with the Freedom Library Day School, right on Ridge Avenue past Girard College. You have institutions like that. But then you also had people in other parts of the country trying to get community control for the institutions that were already there. Because that makes sense, because our tax dollars are being used for these schools.
You know, we
don't know how the tax dollars are being allocated, though.
That you know, that's what I was going to mention, Brother Akil. That I agree with what you suggested about a two-prong approach, a political approach, which entails having conscious black leadership. I'm not talking about this stuff that we have now. Conscious black leadership to redirect these dollars that we pay taxes for to have some real change in some of these public school buildings. Now, the other approach, and they can be done simultaneously, is, we might have a little volume up in either in your background or Brother Richard's, but we'll fight through it. The other approach is utilizing these spaces that we have to re-educate our children. We must do this. And when I say utilizing these other spaces, during the turn of the early 20th century, these houses of worship were used as education houses. They weren't used for our people to be hollering and screaming, hooping and hollering on Wednesdays and Sundays every week. They were used as education houses. They were used as meeting houses. They were utilized. We have to do this again. We have to. Similar to the Freedom of Reconstruction League does when they utilize that public library up there to bring. We got a little interference in the background. If you got volume up in your background, Brother Akil, just turn it down some.
Okay. I just turned. How's that now?
Great. Okay. We got to utilize these public spaces that we have to re-educate our children, similar to what the Freedom of Reconstruction League does when they bring speakers in, including yourself, to talk with the students and the people that's there. We have to start doing this because to develop that independent mindset, we have to develop cultural pride. It's no other nationality that feels as though before they do something for their people, they got to get tacit approval from white folks, or they need white folks to do it. It's no other nationality that thinks that way. And we do it is because of our experiences during chattel enslavement. It's no way to get around it. That mentality has to be broken.
And I agree. And that's why I focused on Brother Kiel's that particular section, because the two words, and you said it in relationship to the pronouns, because if we take ownership, so these two words to me is the not excluding, but I wanted to bring up as far as that uncomfortable conversation, the point of who is this we, which I'm assuming we as Black people in our local areas, but the question of do we really have ownership? See, if there's an assumption that we own ourselves, and if we were owning ourselves, we would act like we own ourselves. Therefore, we would be acting with power and we'd be utilizing our institutions or the institutions that exist. So my question comes, I mean, you know, when we talk about education and we talk about, you know, as you said earlier, education being a socialization process, and it has to take place in a social context. You know, do we operate from the perspective that we are either taking ownership, which I think that's what David Walker was talking about, or are we operating from the point that we have ownership of ourselves? Because if we have ownership of ourselves, then we have ownership of our children. We can say their minds and their bodies. So the question is, do we have ownership? Because if we don't have ownership, then yes, that would be seem to me to be the first step. And I'm kind of open for what y'all would say to that. Do we truly at this point, even 2018, as in when David Walker wrote the appeal in 1823, we know specifically Africans didn't have ownership of their person. In 2018, do we have ownership of our person? Do we even project like we have ownership of our person?
I would say no. Collectively, definitely not. And I think, like, in terms of, like, developing schools and school institutions, I think of – so my background is in business, or at least my undergraduate training. I got a degree in finance. Originally, I never wanted to be a teacher. You know, I just – because I bought into the – I didn't see the value in it, and you know, I think that's part of the problem too. A lot of people don't see the value in being an educator and, you know, building community in that way. But from my business training, one of the many concepts that we're introduced to is this concept of a make. Business leaders, managers have to do a make or buy decision. You know, so it's like in terms of like overhead and like the equipment or the tools that go into what you're developing. Are you going to make it yourself, or are you going to buy something that's already made from somebody else? So. And this is why, like, this is part of the reason I came up with this idea to push back on this idea, this definition of what we accept as a good school, because a lot of us feel that we don't need to control our schools because white people have good schools. And we can just try hard to get our children into those schools. And as long as we try hard and our children get into those schools, then they'll be fine. And that becomes the mentality, and that becomes success, or that becomes quote unquote Black excellence, or, you know, I mean, and again, uncomfortable conversation. So we're going to have to even push back on, you know, so, okay, some Black child in 12th grade that worked very hard and is, you know, very applied himself or herself academically, over many years, gets accepted to all these Ivy League colleges. And we celebrate that. Maybe we shouldn't be celebrating that. You know, maybe we should be looking differently at that. Maybe we should be saying, well, if it isn't ours and we don't control it, maybe we should look at it differently. Maybe we should say, well, is it really as beneficial to us as we think it is? Because it's really about control. Because every other groups control those institutions and those schools. So the question becomes, why can't we control our schools, and why can't they be quality, or why can't we view them and envision them as quality if they are ours? And I think that has a lot to do with the psychology of white supremacy theory and the idea that it's like a zero sum game. So in order for white supremacy to exist, everything black or African has to be inferior. Mm-hmm. I think that, you know, that's one of the fundamental problems. So, you know, so we have to figure out some type of way to separate ourselves from this system and this paradigm, like totally, because we'll always think that, well, you know, the black version or the black alternative or the African alternative will always be inferior, as long as we fundamentally accept that the European version, the European option, is better.
Yes,
we're gonna think the white man has colder ice and wetter water. And I don't know that we can. This is something I think about a lot. I don't know that we can coexist in this system without degrading ourselves in order to support that theory of white supremacy.
Well,
I don't know if that can happen.
And I take Marimba Hani's position that we can't actually continue to do the health work being a part of it because the system is unhealthy. And right. Any interaction. And so we have to be for some time to address the unhealthy position that we're in, have to be isolated unto ourselves to get towards becoming healthy. And that's why the notion of the question of ownership comes up for me.
We're going to take a brief break. And when we come back, we'll continue the conversation with activist and educator Akil Parker. The topic of Pan-Africanism and how we can utilize this to culturally reclaim our people and to re-educate our children. You can get involved in this conversation by dialing 215-490-9832. That's 215-490-9832. We'll be right back.
Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasts or live programming, hit them up at timeforanawakening.com.
All Insurance Incorporated, an African-American owned and operated insurance agency in business for over 20 years, located at 231 Southeastern Road in Glenside, PA, with other offices in Germantown and West Philadelphia. Call now for commercial insurance quotes, homeowners insurance quotes, automobile insurance quotes, notary and tax services, representing over 15 major A-rated insurance companies, offering a discount on all notary services when you call in for a free quote. Call this number, 215-885-2444. That number is 215-885-2444. 215-885-2444. All Insurance Incorporated.
RG Electrical Inspections provides electrical inspections for realtors, licensed electricians, and homeowners. Licensed and insured underwriter, serving Philadelphia and surrounding area. Call today, 484-268-9837.
Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley. Dooley Brothers, specializing in shingle, rubber roofs, gutters, downspouts, and vinyl sidings. Call for your free estimate today. 215-224-3882. That's 215-224-3882. Dooley Brothers Roofing, the roofing experts you can trust. That number again, 215-224-3882. 215-224-3882. Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley.
You have the emergence in human society of this thing that's called the state. What is the state? The state is this organized bureaucracy. It is the police department. It is the army, the navy. It is the prison system, the courts, and what have you. This is the state. It is a repressive organization. But the state, and you, well, you know, you've got to have the police, because if there were no police, look at what you'd be doing to yourselves. You'd be killing each other if there were no police. But the reality is, the police become necessary in human society. Only at that juncture in human society, where it is split between those who have and those who ain't got.
I throw a Molotov cocktail at the precinct. You know how we think. Organize the hood under our chain banners. Red, black, and green instead of gang bandanas. FBI spying on us through the radio antennas. And them hitting cameras in the streetlight watching society. With no respect for the people's right to privacy. I take a slug for the cause like Huey P. While all you fake niggas try to copy Master P. I wanna be free to live, able to have what I need to live. Bring the power back to the street where the people live. We sick of working for crumbs and filling up the prisons. Dying over money and relying on religion for help. We do for self like ants in a colony. Organize the wealth into a socialist economy. A way of life based off the common need. And all my comrades is ready, we just spreading the seed.
The average black male, live a third of his life in a jail cell. Cause the world is controlled by the white male. And the people don't never get justice. And the women don't never get respected. And the problems don't never get solved. And the jobs don't never pay enough. So the rent always be late. Can you relate?
No more bondage, no more political monsters, no more secret space launches. Government departments started it in the projects, material objects, thousands up in the closets. Could have been invested in the future for my comrades. Battle contacts, primitive weapons out in combat. Many never come back, pretty niggas be running with gas. Rather get shot in they back than fire back. We tired of that. Corporations hiring blacks, denying the facts, exploiting us all over the map. That's why I write the shit I write in my raps. It's documented. I meant it. Every day of the week, I live in it, breathe in it. It's more than just fucking believing it. I'm holding in ones, rolling up my sleeves and shit. It's CeeLo for push-ups now. Many headed for one conclusion. Niggas ain't ready for revolution.
The average black male, live a third of his life in a jail cell. Cause the world is controlled by the white male. And the people don't never get justice. And the women don't never get respected. And the problems don't never get solved. And the jobs don't never pay enough. So the rent always be late. Can you relate? We living in a police state.
Welcome back to Time for an Awakening. We're in conversation this evening with activist and educator, Brother Akil Parker. And we're going to go to the phones. Brother Richard, Brother Akil, you still with me? Let's go.
Yeah.
Okay, let's go to the phones. Let's go to 267. 267. You know what? Let me, 267?
Yes, I'm here. Brother Elliot, can you hear me?
Yes. Before you answer that, or before you make a comment or a question to our guest, let me ask you a question and get you to throw your opinion on this because
yes.
Brother Akil put this in one of his writings, and I'll throw it to you. It says, black nationalism and Pan-Africanism, I'm sorry, to prevail among us that do believe that it's not an outdated fantasy that won't work. In your opinion, do you think that Pan-Africanism or black nationalism is an outdated fantasy that can't work?
No, it's not outdated.
Give me your.
Can I give you?
Go ahead.
Can I give you my
my position on it. This brother right here, I'm happy that you're talking, brother, and one day we'll hook up. I'm also educated in the public school system, and you and I have a very similar background. In other words, I went to an integrated school, and I was the first crop to go to a school called Greenfield, 23rd and Chestnut. Okay. And I had to get there because my mother was an educator. And at that time, that was the time of the 60s. And to go to school and a college and university, it was a popular thing, almost like a fad, to want to be black at that time. And at that time, her friends probably became more pro-black than her. But my question is, being around her friends, maybe who I am today. And from Greenfield, 23rd Chestnut, I went from West Philadelphia High School to Lincoln University. So I had very similar experience that you did. And I went to school at Lincoln University. A lot of my friends were from Baltimore and from D.C., PG County. They were from Virginia, New York. They were from all around the country. But some of my best friends were from Baltimore. And they went to Polytech. I made familiar with Polytech. And my thing to you is to say that happy I went to that school, almost any school in the United States, because I had the experience of going with Malcolm X's daughter and Gil Noble's son. It was a place to be in 1979 to 1983. And there's a guy by the name of Earl Scott, and he's now a millionaire. And he donates a lot of money to Lincoln University, and he goes back to the community, and he has the same type of mindset that you and I have. And I'm blessed to have people around that like me. Let's get into now what is nationalism and what is Pan-Africanism, because I believe in independent schools and what we control. Let's first start off with nationalism, and let's use Malcolm X. Malcolm X was a nationalist. He was not a Pan-Africanist. When I say that to you, because he was a Muslim. It's hard being a Pan-Africanist and a Muslim, because I'll tell you, being a Muslim, because the Muslims were involved in the slave trade. Same thing with the Christians. The Christians were involved in the slave trade. Now, the question is with that is, true Pan-Africanism is, Garvey had to learn later on, he wasn't a Pan-Africanist in the beginning, but the Negroes that was around him who were betraying him, and also the white folks that were betraying him and the racists made him that way. Same thing with Du Bois. Du Bois was not a Pan-Africanist in the beginning. I'm going to say this, that Du Bois was an integrationist. Now, people may disagree with me with that. That depends on who you talk to. Are you compromising your culture? You're integrationist. That's another conversation for another time. But we'll get into this, that Du Bois became that because he was around Nkrumah. And Nkrumah graduated from Lincoln University. When you talk about Pan-Africanism, you're talking about soil. There's a difference. Now, Malcolm had evolved into Pan-Africanism? It's possible. I myself am learning every day. So, yes, I believe that when you talk about Pan-Africanism, you're talking about completely different nationalism. You're talking about your institutions African, your business is African, you connect to African soil, your name, your country, and your flag is African. Let's get that right. Let's get that straight. Now, the messenger. I'm a Muslim from Nation Islam. He wanted to build within a nation.
Did you have a question? Did you have a question for Brother Akil?
No, because my question is, we weren't really talking about Pan-Africanism, but I want people to know what it is and what nationalism is. But I'm with you on having independent schools that are African. Do you understand? See my point?
Okay. I hear what you're saying.
Now, do you agree with that or you don't? Or
Some of it. I think of Kwame Ture when he talks about black nationalism, and he refers to Pan-Africanism as the logical extension of black nationalism, and Pan-Africanism being on a more global scale.
I agree with that. That's black nationalism, exactly,
within the United States. But I do want to kind of comment on something that you made earlier.
Right.
A comment that you made earlier, because I was raised Muslim. I'm Muslim.
Right.
I don't know that being a Muslim would preclude one from being a Pan-Africanist because of what the Arabs did, what many of the Arabs participated in. Because I think that was, now I don't, I'm not, And I understand. I think we have to, I mentioned earlier, some uncomfortable conversations. A lot of people in the Muslim community, especially the Black Muslim community, we're going to have to kind of own up to and deal with the fact that a lot of these Arabs were involved in the slave trade even before the Europeans were, that claimed to be Christians. But I don't know that it precludes one from being a Pan-Africanist. Because again, like people say, like, you know, we, like, kind of like the tongue in cheek comment, like, you know, we out Muhammad, as Black people, we out Muhammad, out Pope the Pope. I think that, you know, and Dr. Clark even said, I agree with him when he says that, you know, the Europeans did not have the temperament to truly follow true Christianity, and the Arabs didn't have the temperament to truly follow true Islam. And it was used more as a political tool, as opposed to something spiritual. And our ancestors have always been spiritual. In terms of Du Bois, I would say that, you know, I mean, we talk about the first Pan-African conference and then the subsequent Pan-African congresses. I would say that Du Bois was always a Pan-Africanist as well. I think he experimented with some strategies and some tactics within the United States to try to gain some resources for African people on this soil at different times. So maybe that's where you may be saying that, where you may want to classify him as an integrationist, as certain points in his life, through his 95 year lifespan. But yeah, I definitely agree with you saying that we do need control of our schools, our communities, everything, like political control, economic control, and all the social institutions, all the life sustaining institutions, like Bobby Wright would say, like control of the life sustaining institutions. That's what we need to have. And the schools are the fundamental, and I would argue the most important life sustaining institutions, because that's where you get the training and development to be able to run and manage and maintain all the other life sustaining institutions within the schools.
Okay, can I say something, sir? I want to be able to explain what and brother, we see eye to eye. But my point is, Du Bois grew into being a Pan-Africanist.
Okay.
You know, and I'm going to say this. This is my position and my opinion. And I'm going to say that when I talk about the Arabs were involved in the slave trade, you got to remember, slavery was a common thing amongst cultures. But like David Walker says, nobody practiced slavery in America, shadow slavery, like any other culture. You could have moved up. But my point is that as a Black man, my pilgrimage is Egypt. Prophet Muhammad was late in getting Islam 1,400 years ago. So what I say to you, when it comes to Pan-Africanists, that's everything African. And my thing is that as a Black Muslim, we proceed and we are before a 50,000-year period when there were no Arabs and nothing white on the planet. That's my point. But I'm not taking away from people who acknowledge the Sunnah of Prophet Muhammad. I'm not taking away anything from that. But I want black people should know where the original man is from, where he began and where he's going. And I'm just stating that. I just want to make it clear that what nationalism is. You understand what I'm saying? Uh-huh. And I like what you said about Mark Shedd, because when Mark Shedd was around, I was in elementary school, and I remember Mark Shedd, we striked for a whole month. He was different from Ackerman. He was completely different from Height. He was completely different from this Joker right now. He was all these folks. And Mark Shedd would bring the public school system down to his knees because he was like Scepter. They bowed down. You're not going to never get nobody like a Mark Shedd. But we need to be involved in our schools and make them as independent as possible. Because these state issues, we're going to go from the state to the city. That's going to be another issue. Half of these council people are going to tell me and you, what to do with the public school system. What do they know? They don't teach in it.
Right.
But I like you here, man, because I like to hear what you're saying, because we think along the same lines. And I didn't come here to land bash you. I just came for you just to hear my position. You're doing a good job. I like your thinking.
Well, I appreciate that, bro.
Thank you for your call.
Right.
Let's go to 602.
Yes. Yes, brothers. It's Brother Marcos here.
How are you doing?
All right. You know, what we have to remember about Du Bois, you know, Du Bois became a Garveyite at the end of his life when he got indicted by the U.S. government and he had to flee to Ghana. So you can't forget that point because Du Bois was one of Garvey's biggest enemies. But at the end of his life, the U.S. government indicted him and he fled the country and went to Ghana and died a hero in Ghana. And Garvey died in obscurity in London. Now, what the brother saying, your guess is right, you know. But, let me interject with this, but I remember in the 1990s, when in New York, they were trying to, Lincoln became mayor, and they were trying to get the curriculum of inclusion into the New York City school curriculum, and the then superintendent Richard Green, he was going to do it, mysteriously dropped dead. Boof. Okay, so they took care of that. That was the end of the curriculum of inclusion. And somebody said, "Why would you really want to include your curriculum in that? It's like you having a glass of cyanide and pouring it out." And fill it with juices and vitamins and, you know, minerals. But it's still poison, you see? So we really need a curriculum of exclusion to exclude all them lies that they have told us over the years. Now, I doubt they're going to, for 400 years, they ain't going to give up their school system because that's where they keep manufacturing Negroes. See, with that school system, they keep turning out these Negroes, you see? That's a Negro factory production line. So the idea would be good if we could get into the churches. But in order to get into the churches, we have to get to the people because we know that the preachers, they are the ones that toting the line. They are the ones that keep the people in the frozen psychological state. So it's kind of a, you know, it's kind of a catch because they are the ones who keeping the people in the suspended animation. But at the same time, you know, we need them to liberate the people. We need those institutions to liberate the people. So the only way it's going to work is the people have to push ahead in front of the preacher. Then the preacher, he going to catch up. See? And I notice a lot of churches doing that now. You're going, you see red, black, and green on the wall, stuff like that. But that is because the people pushing ahead are the preacher. So the preacher, he got to play catch up. So that's where we have to go if we really, you know, because those are the institutions we need to help to liberate our people. It's going to be in those churches. Churches shouldn't be just open one day a week or twice a week. To have a prayer meeting and meetings on Sunday, you know, and we, you know, we having all these problems in the community.
Yeah, I agree.
You know, so, you know, we have to do better. Now, one thing, last thing, I got a video about the AU saying that setting up Wakanda One, something about different in various regions in Africa, they want to have areas that Black people from the diaspora can return. I want to know if that's true. You know, it's called Wakanda One, a group out of Los Angeles. They said the AU made that announcement, and it came from ACLU NIA. So I don't know if Richard knows anything about that. And I'll hang up and continue listening. Thank you.
I didn't hear that one, Brother
Mark. I haven't heard that one yet.
You might
all right.
You might be spreading some fake news there, Brother Marcus.
I don't know. I got it this morning, and somebody just saying the AU saying that they're setting up some diaspora, Africa diaspora fund, and Zambia has already donated 123 acres of land to build. You know, so I don't know how true it is. You know, okay. I don't know. But anyway, I'll continue listening, good brothers. Thank you so much.
Thank you for your call, sir.
All
I like the point that the brother brought up. It reminds me of you know, what he talked about, the curriculum of inclusion,
mm-hmm.
and you know, I remember, you know, Dr. Clark speaking on that, and he likened it to the act of pouring clean water into a dirty glass.
Okay.
So, you know, he was saying, you know, so again, that's a reminder that, you know, I mean, we can, you know, I have challenges with the movement to, I guess, like integrate our history into schools that we don't control. I have challenges with it, because while I do think that it's necessary, because that's where our children happen to be, the majority of our children are in those schools. I wonder if that becomes, if our efforts to do that kind of limit our efforts to create the independent spaces where we're not going to have to worry about fighting with these, with principals and teachers that don't want to really teach the true curriculum, and teachers unions that, you know, are going to protect the teachers that don't want to actually really do the work, or, you know, all these different just challenges, you know what I mean? So I have challenges with that. I wonder a lot about that. I need to do some more analysis to figure out, like, what is the best method for us to follow. But I guess it's like that too. It does have to be a two-pronged approach, because we have to be realistic in terms of where the children actually are, and the children are in those schools. But you know, maybe it's, well, not maybe. I do think also, again, in terms of the independent mindset, while our children are in those schools Monday through Friday from 8 to 3 or whatever the hours may be, we do have to create these after-school programs and Saturday programs and Sunday programs and summer programs where we're just like, you know, we understand, and not even, again, like in terms of how we use the English language, not even to supplement what's happening in the schools, because if we say that we're supplementing, then it's kind of like we're offering the same type of information,
mm-hmm.
For the same purpose. But we really have to be honest about the fact that we should be doing something that is really antithetical to what's taking place in these Eurocentric schools, these Eurocentric neo-colonial schools. And we have to be clear about that, because we don't want to duplicate that. We don't want to give them more of what they're already getting Monday through Friday, 8 to 3. We want to give them something different, something that is in conflict with that. I guess we have to be clear about that.
Well,
at the same time.
Listen, I do agree with some of the things that you stated in your writings, that the way they teach our children, or the curriculum that's put forth to teach our children, doesn't teach them to problem solve or to take power in our communities. It just doesn't. It doesn't. It teaches them to look to white folks to come up with solutions for problems in our communities, and beg white folks to take care of these issues, when a lot of these issues we can take care of ourselves. But we do need politically conscious black politicians to redirect these monies that is taken from tax dollars to deal with some of these solutions. A lot of these guys, they're not about that. I mean, I don't know what they're doing in a lot of these offices that they're in, besides going around and appearing on black radio and you know, with the chest puffed out like they, you know, like they want to be recognized in the community. But recognized for what? Look at the conditions of our communities and the conditions of our schools.
I would like to interject that what we also go back and look at the institutions that come out of that two-pronged approach that may be intentionally the third thing as far as the ownership, because we have to own our black bodies. If we don't own it, then being politically or religiously involved doesn't matter. And that's going back to 72, which is interesting to me, because in 72, you had the Black Political Assembly come together in April. And then you had in March. And in April, you had African American Teachers Association. But what came out of what developed was the Council for Independent Black Institutions, which was also founded in 72. Now, those institutions, now the political assemblies, we're still wrestling with, and, you know, Elliot, you know, with Zaki Baruti in is at Detroit, and others who are trying to reassemble Black independent political parties or association, the 1 million conscious and conscientious Black voters and contributors policy and plankwork. So those institutional formations are there that will have influence on the political agenda. But CB, and I remember when CB, became conscious of it, and I mean, they had science fairs, they had Saturday schools, and Churchville was a part of that in Philadelphia with its independent school. So these are institutions that we already have in place, which we need to do the historical and what happened, right? I think a lot of the, we have to, that 72 gets into now, especially when you talk about a person like Rizzo, the military offensive for those type of formations where we said we wanted to create an independent institution from, or we wanted to create a political mechanism that influences how our tax dollars are going to be made, but we would control our political relationships to put policies and procedures in place. Obviously, they were normal. What's that word? They were minimized when we talk about 46 years later, because you can barely hear about any independent Black schools, and you can barely hear about CB. So I think that those institutions are there, and what those, these are the institutions that we should be looking at. And also, like, I think over this weekend, it's Cone, the one that pushed the Black independent theology, Black liberation theology.
Liberation theology, yeah. He passed, he transitioned.
And we have churches that push that theology that today, that those institutions need to be supported. I mean, they, or at least need to be multiplied again like they were in the 70s. I think that those things exist. What we do need to do the analysis on is what occurred, and I believe it was from the state, the i.e. the military, whether it be the secret military force or the overt, call it the police department, FBI, military force, that actually helped in diminishing those individuals that were a part of those formations. I think that has to be placed in this here, when we have this uncomfortable, I like that, because a lot of this is going to be uncomfortable, this uncomfortable conversations we need to have.
Yeah, it's not going to be sweet. I mean, anytime you have a J. Edgar Hoover identifies the Black Panther Party free breakfast program, which was really an educational program and an educational institution in and of itself, and he names that as the number one threat to national security. We can understand the impact and significance of Blacks being educated. I mean, and it goes back further than that. I mean, it goes back to.
Well, brother, Kia, let me just throw this in while you're saying it. I guess he was right. And not I guess he was right. To white folks, he was right. A culturally educated Black man is the number one threat to this nation's national security.
Right. Because that's a remedy. That is a remedy to Black inferiority.
Yes.
And white supremacy cannot exist without in the absence of Black inferiority.
Okay.
It just can't. And America has been founded on and propagated based on the ideals of white supremacy,
I would add that and the Black inferiority is important and to understand as far as that, but it's also the question about power that's the real threat, because if you overcome, as you say, the Black inferiority, then you organize from your center of power, and that's the threat to Western European hegemony.
Right.
Is the question about Africans in the diaspora or on the continent having true power centered in their own historical reality.
Definitely. Because then we can, you know, we can really apply our own cultural norms, and
yes.
we can start having those conversations, and we can start to exist in a different way, and not even this kind of kind of like we don't have to settle for these examples of white domination in blackface.
Right.
A lot of times we end up, you know, having that. That ends up being the case. And we, you know, some of us, we don't notice that that's what's really happening. Or those of us that notice that that's what's happening, we don't think that we can have any more than that. Because we got to really start to, again, when we have those critical conversations and we're thinking critically, we start to examine paradigms. And we start to examine, okay, what are these structures? And what are these, you know, because it's even like in terms of education, you know, I mean, maybe, you know, there are ways of educating our own children that are more consistent with an African-centered worldview.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that, you know, that, so because a lot of times we have the, and this is, I think, what a lot of the, and I mean, again, it's a struggle, and, you know, it's all about progression. We're trying to get to a point, I think, where we dictate everything that we do. But I think initially we end up a lot of times in situations where we're just, we're kind of like, you know, we have these, we make these cosmetic changes and these superficial changes to European systems. But I think we can't stop there. And we have to, and we see it a lot in like some of the Afrocentric charter schools, like in Philadelphia area, maybe. You know, a lot of emphasis on, you know, and I think, you know, there's a lot of reasons for this. You know, not to really throw them under the bus. I think a lot of the people involved are doing the best that they can with the resources they have. But, you know, it ends up being, you know, a lot of dashikis and drums and like hoteps and handshakes. You know,
I'm aware of that.
And okay. But we got to keep moving. But in all fairness, I think we may have to start with dashikis and drums and hoteps and handshakes. We may have to start with that. But then progress on to say, okay, well, if we're gonna greet each other and say hotep, you know, and then shem hotep in response, we say, well, what does that really mean? Like, what was, like, what are the teachings of Ptah hotep? What were our ancestors doing in ancient Kemet? Like, you know, we really have to do that critical thing, you know, and do that real work. And I think that's the successive step, and the steps that we have to do. That's the work that we got to do, and that's what we have to do. We have to teach our children that. So then it won't just be cosmetic. And it won't just be superficial. And then, you know, that's when we can win. We can win when we really do that work. But I think that's the reoccurring theme. Like, we got to be willing to, we got to know what the work that's required is, and we have to be willing to do that work once we identify what's required. And some people aren't willing to do the work, and some people don't think that we can win.
Yes.
You know, I think that in the past, I would say that I used to be a bourgeois Negro, and because I didn't think we could win. So I think, you know, if you don't think you can win, then the best you can hope for is to just mimic, you know, just mimic the white man or mimic the oppressor, you know?
Now Brother Teal, let me go back to that, because usually you don't have people that honest to critically assess their own selves. But when you said that you were in that state, a bourgeois Negro that didn't think we could win.
Right.
Give me a little explanation on that.
Well, that just comes from the reading. I mean, when you, like, you know, when I, you know, you read like books like E. Franklin Frazier, The Black Bourgeoisie.
Okay.
And then, you know, reading that type of analysis, and then you just, you know, you got to be honest. It's like, wow, like, you know, like I see myself in this, you know, and that's why it goes back to the so-called good schools, because I think that the so-called good schools that some of us are able to get into are the training ground for that, because we're really supposed to be that, like, buffer class, you know, that is supposed to help to maintain, you know, the white supremacist structures and to maintain the neocolonialism. You know, that's what we're trained to do. We're not trained, because I mean, it makes perfect sense, because, you know, this is war. This is intellectual warfare. This is war over resources, or war over economics, war over politics. They're not going to train us to beat them. They're not going to train us to be able to stand up for ourselves and empower and be empowered for our own selves and our own community and for our own children. They're not going to do that. And we have to understand that too, what, you know, what we're dealing with. But, you know, just the idea that, you know, you're embracing being, you know, being a bourgeois Negro, you know, wanting to just embrace all those ideals that are just, you know, very like neocolonial, very pro-capitalistic, very individualistic, materialistic. You know, it gets into like, you know, your personal relationships, the way you interact and engage other human beings. It's just not, it's not African, I would say.
And you know what, Elliot and Akil, the thing, and again, I push the paradigm that Negro, that Black bourgeoisie, is a social, economic, political position that bought into the Euro-American, Euro-Western ideal. They want to be a national. They argue for a national identity too. You hear me saying, you say about this here using pronouns. If you look at the history of Black Philadelphia specifically, and you look at the educational, you know, perspective that Black Philadelphia developed when they could not, going back to David Walker period or going back to the 19th century, those free Blacks, they didn't want to necessarily see themselves. They called themselves African for a minute, but they didn't see themselves being a part of the continent of Africa. They were, as you described, wanting to be accommodated in the Western, the white Western European paradigm. And you can look at, and I'm looking at the Vincent P. Franklin's book, The Education of Black Philadelphia, from 1900 to 1930. They did have literary societies. They did do those educational, they did utilize the church. They did create historical societies. They did push African history. But even in doing that, using that, they were still saying they wanted to be a part, or now what they're calling the Atlantic Americans, right? The Atlantic Africans, those who were going to be a part of the Euro-dominated society. They knew that they were trying to get a seat, and they knew if they can act a certain way, they would be able to get a seat in the white power structure. Regardless, that's what their fight was. But there was another, and that's what I think I hear us talking about. There was another formation that did not want, wanted to be, and we call it now sovereignty, wanted to be an independent entity of our own in order to deal with the relationship we felt was necessary from a power perspective, from a health perspective, from a historical perspective. That is different.
And you know, in that whole discussion too, Richard and Brother Akil, you know, I think we have to realize, and just, and you stated it, Brother Akil, about these things being created for the purpose of control. And see, we're in a catch 22, because if we attack these people, which you almost attempted to do all the time, then you play into the Europeans' hands, because that's what he wants.
There you go.
But we have to create. Now, you know, I've been mentioning this, me and Brother Richard on the program, about think tanks, to having these critical discussions. See, if we have these critical discussions, then if a person is sincere, then we'll come to some conclusions that'll benefit our children. See, a lot of these people that are categorized as the bourgeoisie, some of them make a conscious decision that this is what they want to do.
Right.
Others are caught up in it. For example, if I'm a bourgeois Negro, so to speak, or a Negro peen, as one of our calls out of New York says, then I'm making the decision that this is what I want to do. But I got children that I'm bringing along, impressionable minds that'll basically follow along with what their daddy or mommy is putting down. Then you create, you pass this stuff down to other generations. See, we got to look at what's best for our children. Even these people that are out here making this decision to assimilate. I, you know, eventually, I guess we're going to have to ostracize or move forward or whatever. But I don't think initially that we can attack some of these people. I say some of them, because some of them don't really, they're just caught up. Almost like what you described, Brother Akil. Until you understand what you're dealing with, then you can't say, well, wait a minute, hold it. Where am I going? What is this? What am I caught up in? Because if I attack you, then immediately you put up a defense mechanism and you'll never hear what I want to say. So, it's going to take some skillful people. It's going to take some real organizers to get beyond, because this man did a job on our people and he did it strategically.
Right.
Let me try to get a couple more in here, Richard, because, we're coming up on that top of the hour. And let me try to get squeeze a couple more callers in. Let's go to 215.
Yeah, how you doing, Brother Elliot?
How are you, sir?
I'm doing fine, but hey, Brother Richard, how you doing?
Okay.
Praise be to Allah. Brother Akil, assalamu alaikum, my dear brother.
Wa alaikum assalam, wa rahmatullah.
Praise be to Allah. You know, Brother Akil, I'm a Muslim just like yourself, and I was sitting back listening to the conversation that you had with Brother Tim and Brother Marcus, but especially the conversation with Brother Tim. And I like how you, because I'm trying to put the education with our children and the Islam and everything in a certain perspective. And during your conversation with Brother Tim, Brother Akil, I like how you spoke about how, you know, the Arabs, you know, how they didn't have the right temperament for Islam and how the white man had the right temperament for Christianity. And that just proves the teachings of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, which I am a member of. Because if you notice, Prophet Muhammad, and peace and blessings be upon him, who his most trusted servant was Brother Bilal, who was black, who was the call of prayer. And remember, Prophet Muhammad said it clearly. He told all the Arabs back, he said, look, there's no superiority over the black and the white and the white and the black. Because Prophet Muhammad had the foresight to see the racism even back then, and he was cautioning them about, you know, that man whiteness think they were superior over the black man and a black woman. And you can see the world today, Brother Akil, they looking to the black man and stuff to look to be the vicegerent on this earth, to be the servant, the example and stuff. And nobody practices true Islam more than the black man and black woman in America, especially members of the Nation of Islam, the way they respect their women, the way we respect our women, the way our children are well-mannered. Because I know over the years, I've seen black Christian sisters and brothers and stuff that's deep into the church. They say, you know, I'm not no Muslim. You know how they talk. I'm not no Muslim, but I like how those black men, the bow ties, they so respectful. They help the ladies cross the street. They help them. They respectful. They, yes, ma'am, yes, sir. So we are that example and stuff like that. We have the right temperament. We practice true Islam. See, I don't have to paint my bed. If I don't have a bed, Brother Akil, but I don't have to paint my bed red to know I'm a Muslim. It's in my heart. It's in my soul. It's in my DNA. I don't have to prove nothing to no Arab or whatever like that I'm a Muslim. I respect my Muslim brothers throughout the Islamic world, but I know we are the example. The way we treat our children, you don't see no brothers in the Nation of Islam, you know, shooting a little young sister in the head like they did over there in Afghanistan because the sister wanted to go to school. We encourage our women to go to school. We want our women to be the best they can be in life. We don't tell our women they can't drive a car like some of those handkerchief head sellout Negroes do over there in Saudi Arabia. We want our women to be able to drive if that's what they choose to do. You understand what I'm saying, Brother Akil? We're not about oppressing our women. You know what I mean? We want our women to be the example for the world to see. So you're right when you say we have the temperament for it, and we are an example for the Arabs and stuff, and for the whole Muslim world on how a true Muslim man or woman should conduct themselves in their daily life. No question about that. I stand on that with all my heart and all my soul, brother. You know, but when you look at the our children, that's one of the things even Bill Cosby with his faults. He made the comment one time. He spoke. He said that if all black children was act like the Nation of Islam children, the black Muslim children, he said how bad the things would be, because he saw the beauty how these Muslim children in the Nation of Islam, how they carried themselves in school and out in the public and everything like that. But see, again, like Brother Elliot said, you got these Negroes, Brother Akil, that's perpetrating a fraud. They, like you said, they like to get on terrestrial black radio and pump up their chest. But what they doing when you see the hack and conditions of our schools? I saved the article, Brother Akil, that I said out of the Inquirer last year, where right now as we speak to show you how our children are being, black children are being shortchanged. And some in these white schools out in Montgomery County, Delaware County, they have in their schools as we speak right now, brother, credit unions. So these white children are learning financial literacy. They got they open up credit unions in the school where the children during their lunch hour, they can work in the credit union in this school as tellers, customer service, setting up, open up bank accounts right there in the high schools. Why do our high schools don't have those things? We pay taxes just like white folks pay, but because we don't have them, brother, because we got these sellout Negroes that's getting money, that's not staying money towards to improve the condition of our schools, so you can have things like credit unions in schools or banks in schools for our black children, or have, like they had back in the day, the trades and stuff, because every child may not go to college. We had the beautician schools or the auto mechanics in the class or the carpentry. It's no accident why those things are not in our school, but many of those things are still in the white schools, whether it's even some here in Philadelphia, some of the white schools, public schools, and you know they're out in the suburban schools, because we have these sellout black politicians that do our people in. They don't care about it. All them Negroes care about, brother, is getting a paycheck and grinning in white folks' face while their people going to hell in the handbasket. And them Negroes need to be called out for it. But see, we make a mistake as black folk in this city and I guess around the country, because we keep voting for these same Negroes over and over. We put these same sorry Negroes in office over and over again. We wonder why the conditions of our schools and the quality of teachers in our schools and the conditions of our schools don't change. It's like Einstein said, the definition of insanity, brother, is to keep banging your head against the wall and expect a different result. You wonder why you keep getting, but your head keep bleeding blood when you're hitting up against the wall, you expect a different result. Well, that's the same thing with these black politicians, many of them, not all of them, but the many of them, and they know who they are, we know who they are, but we keep putting these same sorry Negroes in office and wonder why, again, the conditions don't change. It, to me, it's not rocket science. It's not hard to figure, brother, you know?
Nah, it ain't hard to tell at all.
It
ain't hard to tell at all.
It's clear cut. I mean, we see it every day. I mean, you see it, Elliot see it, Brother Richard see it. We see clearly what's going on and stuff, you know. I don't want to get too far filled in sports, but you even look at our sports things. You go to these white schools. I was telling Brother Elliot and Brother Richard, Brother Kill, I'm a real estate I'm a novice real estate investor. I did a slow burn back in the summertime. We went up with the Montgomery County up in Bluebell, places like that. We had one of our meetings at one of the schools out there in Bluebell. Brother, that school looked like a college. I mean, this was like a junior high school, Brother Akil. It looked like a college, man. The well-manicured lawn, the gymnasium looked like an NBA court. The football, baseball field looked like Citizens Bank Park or something like that. I mean, I'm saying, wow. I said, why the hell our schools don't have it? We pay the same taxes that white folks pay. We obey the law like the so-called white man obey the law, so he says he obeyed the law. We know that's a crutch in itself. But the point I'm saying is that we do the same thing, pay the same taxes, and follow the same laws that white folks follow. But our kids live in these godforsaken conditions and stuff. You get some of our football fields in the hoods, as you will, and see the broken glass, the trash, the graffiti, the dog feces, all this kind of stuff in our fields. But yet these white kids feels like they look like a professional baseball diamond or something like that. And again, I put the direct blame a lot of it right at the hands of these Negro politicians, because I've said for long, brother, the white man could not do half the stuff he could do to our people in a city, a state, or federal level if he didn't have these Negroes helping them do it, to help do their people in. Because don't forget, when you look at Bill Clinton, again, another devastating thing that happened to our schools, when Bill Clinton did the three strikes your law out, the three strikes rule, when stuff, we're putting black people in jail with draconian sentences and stuff like that. Bill Clinton said right on TV, you know the devil not lying, he said right on TV that while black people mad with him and he could understand that, he said, don't forget, it was black politicians and stuff, prominent black politicians came to me and told me, I want you to come up with these tough laws that gonna punish the black community. He Clinton said they told him that. You know that devil ain't lying. And we know Clinton ain't no friend of black people, but what he said is no lie. Them niggas purposely went there to him, told him to come with these laws, giving police more power to brutalize our people even more, giving these courts more latitude to give our people these ridiculous, draconian sentences and stuff. Bill Clinton didn't do this in a vacuum. He didn't do this by himself. He did this at the urging of these handkerchief heads, sell out black Negroes. And we might as well face the fact and call a spade, brother. It's simple
but
as
at
that.
The same time, but at the same time, and I know you say this, and the challenge is, too, for me, Brother Joe, is the question of the difficult challenge to organize our community. That's, you know, because it's at the community level, as you said, it's the people that elect those politicians.
That's right.
And those politicians don't just go up there and get in that position on their own.
Let me interrupt you, Richard. And that's what I'm saying, Richard, because see, what you need is political education, because see, some of our people, they are politically ignorant. And that don't mean they're bad. They don't know no better. Because you got these black preachers in these churches, they influence our people. See, like Elliot said, think tanks, Brother Richard. That's what you need, some kind of black think tanks, Brother Akil and Brother Elliot, where our people can get well informed, because an informed voter is a dangerous voter when you're informed. When you're uninformed, ignorant, you just go along with the herd mentality and say, because the black, your pastor, who's probably on the take, handkerchief head Christian, pork eating Negro, getting dibs from these Negroes. So he's going to tell them to vote for these sorry black politicians, because as long as they grease his palm, he's going to grease theirs. Well, you got an informed voter, Brother Richard. That's a voter that can make a difference in the community. And that's what we need, informed voters and stuff. And that's what we lacking in the black community.
So one of my initiatives going forward is to start to better utilize and more effectively and efficiently utilize the internet and social media to produce and to disseminate propaganda, positive propaganda for our people, to compete with the prevailing propaganda, which has them unconcerned about politics, economics. And like you say, political education. Like, political education is a key. Like Richard said, you know, the population has to elect these people, or has to not participate in the process, which allows them to be placed in these positions. So I think we have to be propagandized to much more effectively, to get them to recognize. And again, it's about connections. It's about making connections. And again, that takes us back to the critical thinking. Because with the critical thinking, when you apply critical thinking, a lot of times people think one thing don't got nothing to do with the other. But when you apply critical thinking effectively, then you realize, okay, one thing does have something to do with the other. So, and that's like a mathematical thing, you know, like the transitive property. If A equals B, B equals C, C, then A equals D. But, you know, without the critical thinking, the ability to think critically like that. And, you know, sometimes you just need somebody to tell you and show you in a way that you can understand. Like,
exactly. All right,
you know, this politician is the city council member in this district or at large. And he's doing deals. You see him in the picture in this newspaper smiling with this guy and this white guy over here, this black guy over here. He's a real estate developer. And then what they're about to do this other deal over here. And then it's like Malcolm said, like, you know, talking about Lyndon B. Johnson and Richard Ross. He's like, how's he gonna be your friend, his friend too? You know, so we gotta look at all these connections. But again, we have to propagandize to the people, that those of us that do know better. Because I know I used to be a person that would be more on the side of like complaining about what our people are or are not doing.
Okay.
But nowadays I want to be, you know, I've, you know, made a conscious decision to be more of the type to try to alleviate the problem and be more aggressive with alleviating the problem, saying like, you know, okay, well, you know, they lack the knowledge and they lack the understanding. So if I know better, I can do better. And then hopefully I can help them to understand these things. So then they'll be able to do better. And, you know, and with the understanding that, you know, we're not going to reach everybody, but we'll reach enough, you know, enough of our people put forth that consistent effort to try to educate on a regular basis.
Thank you for
your
call,
Joe. And, you know, Brother Kale, I'll close with this. You know, Brother Kale, you made a good point, because I had to chuckle just now. You mentioned about the example that Malcolm used, because with Lyndon Johnson, and you meant to say Barry Goldwater and stuff. Not Richard Ross, but you could have said Richard Ross too, because the way that nigga, when he talked so stupid after the Starbucks thing, I guess you could have said him too. But anyway, right here in Philadelphia, me and Elliot had this conversation. You look at you got a white politician right in this town, Bob Brady, he plays that same game and stuff, mm-hmm. where you got Negroes, you know, here they think they look at this white guy and see some kind of beacon of light for the black. And I've always said this right on the radio to the person that likes this guy. I said, look, brother, I don't want to hear about Bob Brady being a friend of black people, and Bob Brady in the same breath said he's good friends with Mitch McConnell and Paul Ryan, them devils that you know is anti-black, working against the interests of our people. So how the hell Bob Brady gonna be for black people if he's friends with them devils? You know what I mean? So see, again, this is the kind of stuff that the white man plays on our people. When you're ignorant, this is the kind of games they play on our people, man. I'm not trying to hear that stuff about no Bob Brady. Bob Brady is cut from the same cloth as Paul Ryan, Mitch McConnell, and the rest of them bigots up on Capitol Hill. It's that simple, man. You know what I mean? You know, you got to wake up well early to pull that wool over my eyes, brother. I'm not that stupid, you know.
Thank you for your call, Joe.
Hey.
Thank you, Brother Elliot. Peace.
Brother Akil, how's time?
I'm gonna hang with you, but I'm overtime.
Yeah, okay. Brother Kill, you got about 15 more minutes.
Yeah, I'm good.
Good. Let's take a couple more calls here. Let's go to 646.
Yes. Good afternoon to you, good brothers. Enjoying the conversation.
Good afternoon. You know, what do you mean, good afternoon? Huh? What's going on?
Were you in California?
No, brother, no. Listen, don't start, Elliot. You know, I didn't say that to Richard yet, so, you know, I'm not going to say anything. I'm trying to play nice after you got on me last week, Friday night.
No,
brother, you never got on me. And in all seriousness, I just like to ask the brother this, because this is the question that I always ask, but nobody, it seems to me, wants to answer it. If the resources in this country is dwindling, if things are not getting that good for white folks, why do we expect white folks, this Urugu, to honestly educate our children? I just don't understand it. I mean, how does it serve his interest if the resources in the country is dwindling and his children has to compete with ours? What does he gain from educating our children?
He doesn't.
Okay, now, so let's follow that up. Why is it that black parents don't seem to understand that whenever brothers like yourself come forward and try to talk about African independence in education?
Well, I think the main reason is something I alluded to earlier. And I think, you know, we've been programmed and conditioned and socialized to think that we can't win. So, you know, we want to, you know, and then, you know, that leads to like us trying to look good while we're losing. You know, we don't think we can win. And African independence, well, when you talk about African independence, you know, we've been socialized and indoctrinated in a lot of these institutions to hate Africa anyway, and to not want to be associated or affiliated with Africa or anything African. And that's, you know, that still goes on. You know, I mean, you got, you know, youth that, you know, it might be youth in Bartram High School or Southwest Philly that are, you know, born, their grandparents are from Philly, or their grandparents are from South Carolina. But then you have, you know, brothers and sisters from, you know, in Southwest Philly or West Philly, their grandparents might have been born in Liberia, or born in Ghana, or born in Nigeria. And then, you know, they're beefing with each other, you know, because of, and I think that that's fomented, that type of conflict and interaction is fomented because that's meant to be a barrier, an obstruction to Pan-Africanism. Because as long as we're fighting amongst each other, you know, continental Africans and Africans born in America, then, you know, Pan-Africanism cannot really exist and persist and grow. And I think that's one of our solutions. And I think our enemies understand it. I think they've identified that, you know, the power of Pan-Africanism. It's like they knew the power of Pan-Africanism in the era of, you know, Marcus Garvey and Du Bois and Kwame Ture, and even way before with Martin Delaney, way back in the 19th century. And they understood this. So they said, you know, we have to prevent this from becoming a thing.
And the education system ties right into that. You know, we're socialized to think, and I think that, again, psychologically, that word, the term American, so even like the term like African American, I think it cripples us, because this is just one of my theories. I think that the term American cripples us because it kind of ties into the law of self-preservation. If something happens to a black person that is a travesty or some type of tragedy happens to them, and then we understand, okay, this is America did this to me. But then, so you would think that you would want to, you know, reject America or even retaliate against America. You can't do it because you feel like you are an American. I can't attack myself. You know, I think that ties into like the law of that may be some psychological manifestation of the law of self-preservation, which will prevent you. Just like I don't think it's possible for a person to choke themselves to death because of the law of self-preservation. So I think that identification as an American, I think it becomes problematic, and it influences us to never really take a stand against what we've experienced at the hands of this nation and this government and these like kind of fascist corporate structures or corporate entities. You know, that's just a thought I have. So how do we
move forward then? What direction do we go as a people? I mean, what type of moves do we make to get to the point to where, as you know, we have this type of cultural upheaval that we had back when, you know, it was the 80s and the 90s, where, you know, Jeffries and the rest came into prominency.
Right. So here's the thing with that. I think, you know, from the words of the late Dr. Bobby Wright, I think we have to, like he said, we have to lower our focus. I think oftentimes we think, okay, well, in America, there are 40, roughly, you know, approximately maybe 40 million black people. And we often think that, well, you know, we got to organize 40 million black people. We don't have to organize 40 million black people. We have to organize like 40,000 or maybe 4,000. 4,000 serious and committed black people across this country who make serious headway. Because I mean, if you think about other communities, like white communities, like, you know, white people have power, but every white person is not aggressively involved in everything that's taking place that ensures and confirms their power. And that's game theory. Because, you know, in game theory, you have participants, you have the leaders, you have like the mid-range people that are just like the managers that are just promoting the systems, but then may not even understand the significance of what's going on. I mean, that's why you had like, you know, a lot of people are promoting racist policies, but they don't even know that the policies are racist because they haven't done that critical thinking on their own to understand that. But I just think we really just need a critical mass, and just like just some of us have to be committed and do that work, and also consider the fact that another thing about the late Dr. Bobby Wright said is like we might not be meant to see the fruits of our labor in our lifetime.
You know something. That right there is the key, because you have to lay down the foundation of what we're trying to do at this time, because everything, in all honesty, is reciprocal. So you're at a point in time now to where, as things are about to change forward into maybe more of a cultural paradigm like it was back in the day. So, you know, if we could lay some sort of groundwork to this time, make it some sort of prominency, and as Elliot always gets on me about the Negro peen, putting that Negro peen at the back burner of who we are culturally. Because the bottom line is, their whole agenda is to integrate you into whiteness. They're not trying to deal on any real sort of independence or blackness or anything of that nature. So I think that's what we should try to figure out, how you gonna identify yourself and act and behave in a Pan-African way. If you're not gonna do that, then what is gonna be the success of your groundwork that you put forward? Because then they're gonna just tear that down and build back up your Negro peen existence. And when it's all said and done, you're only serving one thing. That's the Yoruba. Never serving right. yourself, and that's our problem. We got to figure out how we're going to serve ourselves. And if we're not going to serve ourselves, why don't we serve ourselves going back homeward bound and building institutions that will lead us there? Because if I know you know this better than most, do you now understand that the big thing that these crackers are trying to do is move forward this whole diversity thing? They just had a big thing this evening on 60 Minutes about how these major universities are putting forward an agenda to diversify their college campuses with the lower tier of minorities. So whereby they can be a part, I guess, of the society and give the illusion of inclusion. That right. if you go to school, you get a degree, and you do all this, that the daddy will let you into his house, you know, and mate with his little Beckmeister. You know what I mean? So, I mean, listen, all I want to do is, like I tell all the kids that I work with in mind, you got to have an African identity. You have to have an African vision. And just do one thing for me. Always look at the world broader than America. Always see that if you learn your couple of languages and you got certain skills, you should be able to, if things get too rough here, to pack you a bag and go somewhere and be able to do certain things. Because remember, to me, that's the only time being the Negro Pean will ever benefit you is if you get out of here and you can do certain things and present certain things, then you may have a chance to survive there better than you will be able to survive here. Because I don't see this situation getting any better for African people unless we unite. Hold tight and have a good evening. And look, Brother Richard,
yes,
please
sir.
Don't work too hard for the daddy this week. Look forward to hearing you bright eye and bushy tail on Friday, knowing that you didn't give it all to the daddy.
I'll work on it. Peace.
Well, you know, like what the brother brought up, Yoruba, you know, and again, with in terms of the critical thinking and like socializing our people differently, like books like that, like those types of texts, are gonna have to be, you know, examined and really broken down, because it's not an easy book to read, you know, but it's dense with information and invaluable information that our people need, like all of our people need that. It's how I haven't finished the book. I kind of started out, you know, reading it slow, like last September, like a little, like maybe a page or, you know, page and a half every day. And then I stopped reading it, you know, jumped into some other things, but I need to jump back into it. But books like that, the ideas need to be taken and used as a positive propaganda for our people to understand like those ideas. Because when he brought up diversity, like Yoruba, like Marimba Ni breaks down how like diversity is just diversity initiatives are a scam because they're not consistent with European culture. Like there's not, it doesn't celebrate and promote diversity. That's just it's a political tactic meant to, again, just like, you know, me going to being allowed as a black person to go to the high school and the middle school that I went to. And many of us, you know, being allowed to go to these so-called good schools is a tactic meant to keep us under control and to keep us from developing our own independent institutions and developing that mindset. One thing I say is that I kind of say this tongue-in-cheek, but I mean, but it's real, though. I think, you know, there's a lot of conversation in Philadelphia and other places about school reform. The only way that these people are going to improve the public schools and these inner city schools is if we develop a sound and quality network of independent African center schools, and there starts to be this major exodus from those public schools. That's the only way. The only way they're going to improve the public, they're going to improve the public schools, they're going to improve the charter schools, they're going to improve these schools that are supported by state government and federal government. That's the only way. Short of that, they have no incentive. There's no incentive to improve anything, because at the end of the day, you look at it from a business model, it's like, okay, we're the only game in town. You're still going to send your kids here. You can complain all you want, but you're still going to get your children up every morning. You're going to send them to school. You're going to keep going to Flint and O'Hara, buying them uniforms, you know, the uniforms that we tell you that they got to wear, you know, so we can get them, you know, used to you know, having a uniformity in their physical appearance, and then hopefully that translates into a uniformity in thinking, and, you know, then they conform and they don't want to be independent thinkers, you know, you're still going to send your children to our school. So, yeah, so that's the only way. So that, you know, that puts the onus on us to, you know, but hopefully, you know, even if they improve them, it's like, well, nah, the children already left and they're over here with us now, you know. So, you know, you can keep your schools at that point. But I think that's the only way, because that would be another concession. You know, it wouldn't be a victory for us, but a victory for us per se. It would be a concession made by them in order to regain power over us. Because once they're not educating us, they can't control us. Or once they're not schooling us, I should say, not educating, schooling or training, they can't really control us, I don't think.
Brother Keel, listen, man, I want to thank you for being with us, man. Thank you for sharing with us. And also, moving forward, any type of initiative that you're putting in the community that you want to talk about, to bring information to the listening audience, the door is open on Time for Awakening, so you can come on here and let us know what's going on.
I appreciate that, brothers.
I'm going to reach out to you. I'm going to get Brother Richard to reach out to you, because me and Brother Richard have been kicking around some things, and we want your input. We want Carl Tone Jones' input. We want Brother Oba's input. We want Mitchell Chance. We want some of these men involved. And we got to put this thing together, but we're going to come to you and let you know what we're trying to do, and hopefully we can get your men's input.
Definitely. I'm with it.
We'll talk soon.
All right. You have a good evening.
Peace. Thanks.
You too, Dan, bro. Peace now. Thank you.
Peace.
Brother Richard, come up on the end of a program. It was a spirited discussion. Usually we go a little bit later, but it ain't no problem. We got to do what we got to do sometime, but it ain't no problem. listen, before we leave this evening, I want to let everybody know about the lineup. And you ought to be familiar with it now if you listen to Time for Awakening. Monday starts out with African Perspectives with Brother Oshie. Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m., African Perspectives with Brother Oshie. Dynamic program. Tune in and listen to Brother Oshie. Later on Monday at 6 to 8, Acres of Diamonds with Brother Jihad Ahmed on Time for an Awakening. That's Acres of Diamonds from 6 to 8 on Time for Awakening. And from 8 to 9, Let's Buy Black 365 Connect. Let's Buy Black 365.com Connect with Sister Nataki and Brother Saber is on from 8 to 9 on Time for Awakening. Tuesdays, Black Reality Think Tank with Dr. William Rogers is on from 8 to 10 on Time for Awakening. On Wednesday, you'll probably hear podcasts of Revive with Sister PLC, because she's not back from the continent yet, so she's still away. And when she gets back, she'll start her regular broadcasts back with live broadcasts on Wednesdays and Sundays. On Fridays, Time for Awakening is back at 8 o'clock on Friday evening, and then Saturday, SST. Saturday is SST. Saturday Sports Talk with Brother Troy Wilmore is on from 10 to 12 on Time for Awakening. I want to thank the listening audience for listening to the program this evening. Lively discussion, as always, and we'll be back on Friday, Lord willing, to continue on this path towards an awakening. Peace.
Peace.
Your children playing after school. They seem to be so unaware. I know the things that they'll soon have to take care of.
my little Tommy, he said he wants to be a fireman. And little Mary, she said she got to teach school.
Children.